well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me today. Hope you had a good weekend. Ryan Petty is going to be with us here in just a moment or two. A few days ago, he and Aiden Johnson from Gun Owners of America had a piece of the Washington Times talking about his idea or their idea for what should happen to the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. You know, last week we spoke with Diana Mueller from Women for Gun Rights about her idea on what should happen to that White House office, which, you know, again, has given the gun control lobby not just a seat at the table, but quite literally an office, not in the West Wing. I think it's housed in the executive office building, but they have an office again with the president's here, certainly the vice president's here. And so the question then becomes, when Joe Biden is no longer the president, when Donald Trump takes office, J.D. Vance is the vice president, what should happen to that office? Obviously, I think we're all in agreement that the gun control lobby should be ousted, right? But should the office itself just be shut down? Or should it be retooled, rebranded with a new mission and a new focus, one that would give gun owners and Second Amendment advocates not just, again, a seat at the table, but a perch within the executive branch itself? I'm all in favor of that. I think this would be a wasted opportunity just to boot out the anti-gunners and close up the shop entirely. Diana Mueller of the same mind, and Ryan and Aiden also on board with the idea of keeping an office in place, albeit with a very new mission. So let's get right to it. Kick off our conversation with Ryan Petty. Take a look and a listen. Ryan, it is good to see you, sir. Thanks very much for coming on the program today.
Cam, it's always great to be with you and great to see you.
So we've been talking quite a bit about the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention here on the program and what happens to the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention once Joe Biden is out, Donald Trump is in. We had Diana Mueller from Women for Gun Rights on the program last week, and her idea is, she had actually had asked this on her Instagram page, you know, should we replace this White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention with something else, or should we just, you know, kill it off altogether? And obviously, you know, folks with varying suggestions here. I will say that I am in favor, like Diana, of replacing the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention with something that is going to be more beneficial. I think it would be a mistake to lose that bully pulpit. You know, the gun control lobby has been pretty smart in getting themselves a seat at the table in the White House itself. And so I think it would be a huge mistake for gun owners to just let that opportunity pass by as opposed to fight fire with fire. And so you and Aiden Johnston with the Gun Owners of America had a piece at the Washington Times recently talking about what you would like to see happen to that office, right? And you want to see it replaced with the White House Office of Violent Crime Prevention, right?
Oh, we would, Cam. And thanks for, you know, letting me come on and talk about this a little bit. Because, you know, my first instinct was this same as we saw from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. They came out with an op-ed just days before we did, which I was excited to see them thinking about this too. But Their idea is just get rid of it, right? Let's just get rid of it, because then, you know, the next time we have a Second Amendment unfriendly, that's a euphemism, president, then they have to reset up the infrastructure and do all this all over again. And that was sort of my instinct and my gut, and that's kind of where I was at. But as I started to talk to various organizations and what I consider thought leaders in the 2A community, the consensus seemed to be, no, let's replace it. Let's not just get rid of it. Let's take this opportunity. Let's take a lesson from the gun control advocates and having that bully pulpit right in the White House and being able to direct and lead and guide federal agencies. It's a great way to coordinate. Think of that office almost as a quarterback for all of the federal agencies that are all doing, you know, they're all busy doing their own things, a lot of which you and I don't like and don't think they need to be doing and don't think is necessary. But we've got to deal with the reality that's on the ground right now. We have a DOJ that has been politicized against the Second Amendment and against gun owners. They are manipulating crime data, as we know. They are not putting a gun-friendly view of the research that they do have, or often excluding things like defensive use of guns. We've got a CDC now that's doing all kinds of health research, you know, and trying to encourage the medical community to talk to gun owners and tell them, you know, these things are bad. They're like cigarettes, you know, and you shouldn't have them in your homes and you shouldn't have them around kids. And so we've got this politicized and weaponized federal bureaucracy that it is what it is. And so I think that the more that I listened to folks that know a lot more about how all this stuff works than I do, the more I started to realize, hey, maybe what we ought to do is capture this ground, let's repurpose it. And in our view, we should be focused on violent crime in America, because we know that's a problem. And the voters clearly told us in the last election, they did not believe the line that was coming out of the federal bureaucracy and certainly from the Democratic apparatus, including the media, that crime was down. You know, we just instinctively knew that wasn't true. So let's quarterback the federal agencies on this. Let's focus on violent crime. Let's make American cities, and even those in blue states with blue cities with really bad district attorneys, let's go in and make sure that everyone has an opportunity to be free, to be safe from violent criminals, and an opportunity to thrive and prosper. So this is goal number one, right? And there's a bunch of other goals. I'm sure we'll get into that, but if we could focus on violent crime and violent criminals and putting those violent criminals behind bars, then I think we would actually see crime go down in the United States. And I think everybody would feel safer. And I think it's a political opportunity for a big win for President Trump and the new administration.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I want to quote from the piece that you and Aidan Johnston had at the Washington Times, where you talk about this, right? You say U.S. attorneys will play a critical role here when you're dealing with soft on crime, local prosecutors, or, you know, blue state policies like sanctuary cities. You say the feds can step in and put these individuals behind bars or transfer them to the Department of Homeland Security for deportation. But you also point out that many federal prosecutors have, neglected their responsibility to prosecute crime, right? You say in D.C., 500 known criminals commit 70% of violent gun-related crimes, but in fiscal year 2022, the U.S. attorney declined to prosecute two-thirds of those individuals who were arrested by D.C. police. And you say it's no wonder that crime is up 40% in our nation's capital year over year. So there are a couple of things, right? I mean, you talk about, again, that small percentage of individuals who are committing a disproportionate amount of violent gun-related crime. But also to your point about, an Office of Violent Crime Prevention, most violent crime does not actually involve the use of a firearm, right?
That's right. Dr. Lott has done some research on this, and it's only like 8% of violent crime includes the use of a firearm. Yet that is the entire focus of the current Biden administration, is gun control. They view gun control as a solution to violent crime. And really, even if they were correct, which they're not, which we know they're not, even if they were correct, it would have a de minimis effect on the overall crime rate. So the focus really ought to be on violent criminals and violent criminal activity, not gun control as a solution to that. And certainly not, this is where they go completely off the rails. They are looking to penalize, as you know very well, Cam, law-abiding gun owners. That they want to make it more difficult to exercise your Second Amendment rights, as if that's a solution to violent crime. So not only are they missing the boat on the number of crimes that are, you know, that involve a firearm, they're also penalizing the wrong people. And we think this office could help direct federal agencies to focus on the things that will really make a difference in solving violent crime and focus on the criminals, not law-abiding citizens.
You know, and again, you're not going to get any dispute or debate with me on that. My only area maybe of disagreement is that I'm not sure that that goes far enough, Ryan, right? I mean, when you look at what the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention is doing, It's not just about preventing, quote unquote, gun violence, right? As you say, it really is about attacking gun ownership, right? Whether it's the collusion that we've seen from, the White House and cities like Chicago and going after, Glock, to the, federal funds that are being directed towards promoting things like red flag laws. So that's my only area of concern is that, when we talk about this bully pulpit, I don't disagree with anything you or Aiden wrote. But I would also like to maybe see that idea expanded out to include support for responsible gun ownership, right? So instead of directing money towards red flag laws, why don't we direct some money towards setting up ranges where folks can get firearms training? You know, here we are. It's been, almost 15 years since the McDonald decision struck down Chicago's ban on handguns. There's no gun range in the city of Chicago. There's no publicly accessible gun range in Washington, D.C. I think there's one in New York City, maybe two in the five boroughs. I've talked a lot about this with Jim Wallace and the Gun Owners Action League because Massachusetts recently instituted a live fire training mandate. There are only like four publicly accessible ranges in the entire state of Massachusetts. None of them state owned. These are all, private entities. So what do you think about the idea of also using this White House office, a revamped, rebranded, retooled office to not just address violent crime, but also, again, to promote a culture of responsible gun ownership in this country?
Cam, I love it. And I think you'll see future opinion pieces come out where we talk about that specifically. What got me started down this path was I'm so tired. Let me say this the right way. I'll never tire of defending the Second Amendment, but I'm tired of always playing defense. And I think we as gun owners have an opportunity with the new Trump administration to think about an offense, right? And it would be, in a way, recovering the true spirit of the Second Amendment. We have lost what our founders gave us, and we need to reclaim that. That's going to require us to do what you're saying, which is to push back against the cultural narrative that's out there right now that our guns are bad or guns are unsafe or guns are just for a certain, certain people that hunt and kind of those crazy guys like us that want to defend their homes and that kind of thing. And we really need to reclaim the culture. And so if we're going to do that, we've got to start with education. We've got to start with training. We've got to get people need access to ranges. We need things like, and we called for this, national reciprocity at the federal level. So let's just take the states out of it and just say, hey, let's do national reciprocity. Instead of supporting red flag laws, let's go for this true crime thing, this thing that Aiden has been pushing for a number of years, that let's stop doing the red flag thing and violate gun owners' due process rights and then not actually solve the problem, as you and I have talked about extensively. Let's actually go after real violent criminals, and let's do that. So national reciprocity was one idea, but it's maybe there's some sort of federal preemption law that prevents states or local communities from infringing on Second Amendment rights. Let's look at this as a true civil rights issue. I'll turn a phrase from you. This is the civil rights issue of our day, I think. And we need a federal government that is not only we need the federal government to do a 180 here and get into the mode of defending the Second Amendment and our civil rights as Americans. And that is the proper role of government. So ultimately, what we'd like this office to turn into are advocates for our Second Amendment rights and pushing federal agencies to encourage the exercise of the Second Amendment, as we should with, like we do with the First. This is the thinking behind this. It'll take a while to get there. So the first thing is, hey, let's make sure the Trump administration, has good crime statistics. So when they go to the public and they say, hey, we're going to implement policy X, Y, or Z, that they've got good sound research and data to back that up. Number one. Number two, let's stop this inane attempt to solve our violent crime problem by blaming guns and blaming gun owners and seeking to restrict the Second Amendment And third, let's quarterback and tie all these federal agencies' efforts together. I mean, if we're going to, you know, make America safe, we've got to have a coordinated federal response, and they've got to be working on the right things. But then we also, you know, to your point, as a second phase, I would say almost let's encourage the exercise of the Second Amendment by American citizens. That's ultimately how we will stay not only a safe society, but a free society.
Cannot disagree. But let me ask you this, Ryan. You know, we New York Times had a piece over the weekend about what Trump plans on doing with the ATF. And, you know, we haven't seen Trump's ATF director nominee. In fact, according to the New York Times, it might not happen until the spring. But some of the names that were mentioned, I'm pretty pleased by Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, Pete Frisselli, a retired deputy assistant director of the ATF and one of the Fast and Furious whistleblowers. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to talk with Pete, but he's been a frequent guest here on this program over the past year or so. And he's a good guy. I fully would be on board with Larry or Pete. Blake Masters is another name that's been bandied about. So we haven't talked about who would head up the White House Office of Violent Crime Prevention, but I want to ask, have you heard from anybody? Have you talked to anybody on the Trump transition team, either about your column or your ideas? Do you have any sense of where the Trump administration is on this issue?
So, as you know, Cam, I had some friends in the previous Trump administration that worked very closely with the president. We worked on schoolsafety.gov as an example. We worked on the federal school safety study with Secretary DeVos and that group. So I was actively involved with them. And some of those folks are back with President Trump for this second term. They're aware of the op-ed. They certainly, I think if they weren't already thinking about this, they've certainly had the idea planted, and hopefully they'll look at that and say, you know, get this to the president so he can make a decision on it. The last thing President Trump needs is, you know, a bunch of gun control advocates in the White House, you know, with that's the last thing he needs. Now, with regards to the ATF, look, any of those three individuals would be fantastic. I mean, I don't know. I know Larry Keene, and I know Blake Masters. Either one of those gentlemen would reorient that ATF to the point I was making earlier. The ATF, look, again, they are to enforce, you know, they do enforce federal firearms regulations, but they're also, they play an important role in anytime you regulate an industry, you've got to have people that understand that industry. And for so long, Washington has, in my view, not understood the firearms industry or what the firearms industry needs to be successful. They've made value judgments that what we do as firearms dealers or as firearms manufacturers is a necessary evil or something along those lines. And so they've sought to be as restrictive as possible. And I think you put a guy like Larry Keene in, or you put a guy like Blake Masters in, that whole orientation changes. And now all of a sudden the ATF is coming alongside the industry to partner with them, to help them, again, obey the law. We all get that. But also to flourish. There's a word you don't often associate with the ATF, but that should be the role of government. They should be like a small business administration that's there to encourage small businesses to grow, not to try to find ways to restrict the growth of the industry. And so any of those names, Cam, any of those gentlemen would be a 180 degree shift for the ATF. And quite honestly, I think the lion's share of the ATF agents and inspectors and I think the lion's share of them would welcome the change.
I do too, to be quite honest. All right, last question. If Donald Trump came to you tomorrow and said, Ryan, I want you to head up the White House Office of Violent Crime Prevention, would you have any interest? Would you say yes?
Look, if if President Trump, I mean, I'm going to say what everybody would say, which is if President Trump asked me to serve my country, I would find a way to do that. That's how much this country means to me and my family. And when you think about what a blessing and what a gift it is to live here, we all need to find our way to pay back. So I would seriously consider helping in that regard, but I think there are a lot more qualified folks out there. I just had an idea and some time to write, and I really appreciate the work that Aidan Johnson and Gun Owners of America put into this, because they really, really turned this into something that I think is viable, and thought about it in ways that I didn't. So kudos to Aidan on this too. But there are a lot of folks more qualified than I am to run something like this. I think you have to understand how the federal government works. And again, my inclination is probably similar to your inclination, which is I'd like to see a whole lot less federal government.
Yes. But the government that we do have, as you say, needs to be working for us, right? Mm-hmm. And not against us and not against our rights. Ryan, it is always a pleasure to spend some time with you, man. I really appreciate you coming on the program today. And I look forward to continuing this discussion in the very near future, because I think we have a lot more to talk about as we get closer to the Trump administration 2.0 officially beginning.
It's an exciting time, Cam. It's like morning in America.
That's right. Ryan Petty, thank you again, sir. If we don't talk to you before then, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year, Cam.
My thanks to Ryan for joining me on the program. I almost didn't ask him that question, what he would do if Donald Trump tapped him. And I think that was a very honest reaction from Ryan. I know he's got a lot of stuff going on. He's very active, with the Florida State Board of Education, very active in promoting school safety. But you know, he says he can think of a lot of other people who would be more qualified. I think Ryan would actually be a pretty good choice, if not maybe to head up that office, but to certainly be a part of that office. Might have to work on the work from home policies there, because I don't know that Ryan would necessarily want to move to D.C., but I think it would be a huge addition and a positive addition to any efforts coming from the White House and the Trump administration to combat violent crime and, of course, to promote responsible gun ownership as well. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with this headline. Suspect in 11 murders has probation revoked in 2019 shooting. Why was he free during two mass shootings? This is in Alabama. Damian LaRon McDaniel III, charged with killing 11 people and wounding 29 others in five separate incidents between July and September of this year, charged with two shootings in Birmingham, one outside of the Hush Lounge in September, another at the Trendsetters Lounge in July, also charged in several other murders, and according to law enforcement, violated his probation from a 2019 case by being recorded on social media brandishing firearms at least nine times between April of this year through October the 1st. McDaniel, Jefferson County, and Bessemer County prosecutors all contended that McDaniel had violated his probation terms by engaging in, quote, injurious and vicious acts. Now, McDaniel, as I mentioned, already on probation for a 2009 incident at Fairfield High School, pleaded guilty to that case in April of last year to two counts of attempted murder. So why was he out on the streets? I mean, again, attempted murder, that's a pretty serious charge. And McDaniel was sentenced to 15 years in prison with just 2 years to serve, though, followed by 3 years of probation. So technically and theoretically, if he violated the terms of his probation after he spent the 2 years behind bars and got out, then the remainder of that sentence could have been imposed on him. But again, why just 2 years for two counts of attempted murder? Why 2 years to serve? Again, 15 years on paper, but just 2 years to serve. AL.com says there's been criticism about the sentence of probation in the Fairfield cases, which put McDaniel back on the streets, where again, he allegedly killed 11 people in a span of roughly 2 months, according to prosecutors. But one of the prosecutors involved in that case last year said that they were actually fortunate to obtain a conviction at all by getting McDaniel to plead guilty and the 15-year split sentence of time served while awaiting trial and probation. Prosecutors said that they had no one who was willing to come forward with information, saying that's not the usual sentence for attempted murder. But when you have no witness cooperation, like in most of his cases, because of fear, probably, we were lucky to get that. And prosecutor went on to say he wasn't released early. He got what he got because no one was willing to cooperate. That Assistant District Attorney Elaine Tolbert saying that to AL.com. Which, okay, let's consider that for a second, right? Sometimes the cases that we deal with here do involve a judge just giving a bizarrely lenient sentence. In some cases, prosecutors go along or maybe even suggest a bizarrely lenient sentence. But Tolbert is right that if you don't have witnesses, if you don't have strong evidence, if you are concerned that, okay, we know this guy did it, but are we going to be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that this guy did it, then maybe offering a plea deal, even one with a sweetheart term like 2 years to serve, is in the interest of justice if the other alternative is somebody simply going free. I can understand that argument. However, I would like to know what other evidence beyond the lack of eyewitnesses prosecutors had to go on. They clearly had enough to indict him, right? In fact, they clearly had enough that McDaniel was concerned enough about being convicted that he took a plea deal where he admitted to 2 counts of attempted murder because he knew that he'd only be spending a couple of years behind bars. And the alternative for McDaniel, of course, would be conviction and then maybe spending 20, 30 years behind bars. So while the prosecutors had to make a decision, McDaniel did too. And McDaniel decided it was in his best interest to take that plea. So I understand where the DA is coming from, or the assistant DA is coming from. But I'm not sure that we actually know enough to say, okay, this was a bad deal, but it was the best one that you could have gotten. And again, at the end of the day, with this individual, again, charged and suspected of 11 murders in the year since he was released, it is not only fair to ask those questions, it is necessary and incumbent to ask those questions. And it is incumbent on local law enforcement, whether it's the police or the prosecutors, to be fully transparent with the public about what transpired to allow this individual to so quickly return to the streets. All right, now on to today's armed citizen story from Florida, where a suspected burglar was shot by a homeowner in Miami Lakes during an attempted break-in over the weekend. We don't have a lot of details about this, but here's what we do know from CBS in Miami. It was a Sunday morning. The suspect was not killed. He was wounded, put in cuffs and airlifted to a local trauma center for treatment, but he is expected to make a full recovery. Alfonso Nieto told the CBS News in Miami that he heard a commotion in his neighbor's backyard on Saturday night. Said he heard a woman screaming, "No, no, 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 no." And then he heard a gunshot. Miami-Dade police telling CBS News in Miami that someone was trying to break into the home. Nieto said, then the shot came. What I hear is that they shot the guy in the leg. Miami-Dade police said the homeowner shot a person who was trying to break into his house. So we don't know where the woman yelling, "No, no, 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 no," may have come from. Maybe another member of the household. Ophelia Martinez told CBS News in Miami she thought she heard some loud noise on Saturday night, woke up to the crime scene tape just outside her door. She said, "We're worried now. We don't know whether that suspect came from or where that suspect came from, what his intentions were, if he knew the person or not." Nieto said the homeowner, who apparently acted in self-defense and maybe defense of others, is, quote, "a really good guy. Says he's been so helpful to us in our house. If we need something, he's helpful." Miami-Dade police, according to CBS in Miami, have not identified the homeowner or the suspect at this time. They continue investigating, but at this point, again, it appears to be a case of self-defense. We'll keep our eyes open for any more details out of Miami-Dade, Florida, and bring them to you as they become available. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to lend a helping hand. This was not a life or death situation like some of our Good Samaritan stories, but still a very good deed done on a icy, wintry night in Nebraska, where a Good Samaritan helped a driver out in Buffalo County. According to, what is this, 1011 Now, KOLN and KGIN in Lincoln, Nebraska. A gentleman named Carl West was heading back to his house in Lexington, Nebraska. Icy conditions, and his tire ended up coming off of the rim as he's driving down this icy road. He's able to pull over, but he didn't have a spare. A gentleman named Nicholas DeLong, driving by, saw what happened, pulled over, stopped to help. He actually had a spare tire and a rim for the same pickup that Carl West was driving. So according to KOLN, a deputy ended up providing traffic control, put out some flares, shown a headlight on the Carl West's truck, so that Nicholas, who went home, grabbed some tools, and then went back to help Carl get back on the road, could see to change that tire, take the rim off, and put the new tire on. Again, you know, not a, like I said, not a life or death situation, but still, a stranger in need helped by another stranger who was in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. He could have driven by. He could have gone back to his house, been nice and warm and toasty. But instead, he did what he could to help a complete stranger have a better day. So, Nicholas DeLong, there in the Cornhusker State of Nebraska, we thank you for your very good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Camp and Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being part of the program. I am hoping, knock on wood, to be back with you again tomorrow. Don't have a TMI update for Missy for you today, other than the fact that she is still, unfortunately, in the hospital. And we are certainly in continued need and desirous of your thoughts and prayers. So thank you again for keeping her in your thoughts and prayers. I certainly do appreciate it. And again, I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Make sure you check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. Tom Knighton keeping you up to date. I have actually contributed some stories there today. John Petrolino has a piece as well. But we are all keeping you up to date on the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And we look forward to doing this again very, very soon. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.